The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So often as we, come to a meditation practice, especially a mindfulness practice, and we turn to our experience, we start paying attention to what's going on in our hearts, in our bodies, in our minds. And so often we feel and experience a lot of struggle. We turn and there's confusion in there, and there's anger in there, and there's frustration and irritation and agitation and wanting and longing and so many different things going on in our minds as we simply turn and start looking at our experience. And so a lot of our practice and our path has to do with this flavor of meeting challenge in our hearts and minds. There's a lot of wisdom that grows as we do that. A lot of understanding about how our minds get caught and struggle. And so often the path has this flavor of, it's sometimes, when the Buddha framed his teaching, he framed it in terms of suffering. the Four Noble Truths are framed in terms of suffering. There is suffering in our hearts and minds. When we turn and look there, he's not saying it's always there, but that this is a frequent visitor. There's suffering in our lives. Everyone goes through that. And so there is suffering. And his encouragement to us is to understand that suffering, to turn and meet it with mindfulness, to recognize it, to begin to understand how it functions, how we get caught, what's happening. Essentially, he wants us to understand how what's happening in our own minds is contributing to how we are struggling. And so this is a large part of his teaching, is understanding suffering. And he points us to understanding that suffering. We begin to see that there's a wanting, a craving for things to be other than they are. That's a large contribution to our struggles. And then he points to the possibility of freedom from that craving. He points to the possibility of letting go, of wanting things to be other than they are, of struggling against the way things are. Maybe I should say that, to letting go of struggling with the way things are, so we can meet and navigate the world with a more open heart, so that we can walk through the world without so much constriction. And then he says there's a path to this letting go. And so much of the teaching is framed in this way. And our mindfulness practice often meets struggle. That at times we might wonder, where is it? Where's the joy? Where's the happiness? Where's the delight? Where's the ease? Where's the peace? And I'd like to talk about that part tonight some. Actually, in some of the teachings, the path of practice is described as leading to basically open heart states of love, of compassion, of joy, and of equanimity. And there's one description of the path of practice that basically describes first this process of struggling with or learning to understand our difficulties, to learning to understand our suffering. And he names all these different reactive states that we work our way through. And after that process, he says, when one has fully understood that suffering, it is abandoned. And when it's abandoned, There's confidence that arises in the practice because the abandoning of those reactivities gives us a different perspective on our lives. So we see things in a new way. So with this wisdom, this understanding, the willingness to turn and meet our experience begins to kind of massage our hearts a little bit so that they can start to let go, abandon these states of reactivity. And because of that, seeing things in a new way, the sense of confidence begins to arise. A sense of trust in the teachings, a sense of that, oh, maybe this is a direction that I can head. For myself, this kind of feeling of, wow, when I turn and look at my reactivity, when I turn and look at these challenging states of mind, and begin to, very early in my practice, this was pretty much all I was looking at. Looking at my anger and my frustration and my rage. And I began to find, even in the first few months, I found times that as I was turning and paying attention to it, that it would fall away and I would experience a release from it. I would experience a letting go around that anger and that frustration and that rage, that loneliness. And in those moments of seeing that, my heart said, this is a path that will help me. I had a deep sense of, yes, this is a direction that will be helpful. And so there's a sense of confidence, not just in something that some book I read or something somebody taught me, but in my very ability to engage with those teachings and those practices, so that there was confidence that this was a direction, so that the heart was kind of orienting in a new direction. And so there's this confidence that arises, that yes, this is helpful, this is valuable, this kind of turning towards challenge and struggle actually alters the landscape of the heart and moves us in a new direction. And that new direction in this one text that I'm referring to, that new direction lands us, at least so the sutta describes, it lands us in love, in compassion, in joy, and equanimity. And that's amazing to me. You know, it's kind of interesting to me that the path through paying attention to our suffering. The next thing in that sutta says, and then one is in a space where there's a boundless experience of love, a boundless experience of compassion. How on earth does this happen? That was my question as I read that. You know, as I read that text, it's describing the path of practice and, you know, it's going along. It says, and confidence arises. And the next thing it says, and one is resting in boundless love. It's like, wow, how do you get from there to there? You know, what's happening in that? And so I began exploring, you know, the way the practice works from the perspective of, you know, how does the heart begin to shift as we do this practice, as we turn to what's challenging? Really, it feels to me like there's a deep interweaving of this. When the teachings ask us to understand suffering, there's that path of understanding suffering interweaves a cultivation and a development of love and compassion all at the same time. So the Buddhist teachings really include a cultivation of these beautiful heart qualities as well as the cultivation of wisdom, of understanding, that which, you know, we're asked to do to understand our suffering. But as we do that, the heart It's like the heart is massaged and begins to transform. So there's a kind of an integration of the heart and the mind in the Buddhist teachings. And right from the very beginning, actually, he speaks about the cultivation of generosity and ethics. When he started teaching, particularly when he taught lay people, that's the first place he started. He taught about cultivating an open heart of generosity and a heart of ethical conduct. And right there, both of those practices that he taught begin to massage our hearts. The practice of giving, of generosity, if we explore it with curiosity, it begins, I mean, actually both generosity and ethics are a practice of connection and community. And they are practices of relationship. So these practices of relationship that he's asking us to engage in from the very beginning, of generosity and of ethics, he's pointing us to connection, kindness, caring, compassion. The act of giving is an act of kindness. When we see somebody in need, the act of giving is an act of kindness or compassion. And it also can inspire in us, if we're kind of available for it, it can inspire in us a sense of delight in the giving. And I'd like to suggest that, you know, practicing generosity, exploring where it is that it feels like generosity. You know, sometimes we just sit in our homes and, you know, read these things that come in the mail and, you know, write checks and, you know, just send them off. And there's not much engagement of heart there sometimes. So, you know, it can help to reflect on who might be served by this, or to actually engage more directly. I mean, sometimes simple things can help us connect to a generous heart. And the joy, the delight that comes with it. At one point, I had received a gift myself, and that was delightful. I was on a long retreat, and I had been sent a box by my friends from home. And I didn't know that I'd gotten the box until the retreat ended. So I was there and somebody, you know, pointed out to me that I had this box. And so I got the box and I opened it. And inside it was a pound of See's chocolate and two bags of barbecue potato chips. And both of those things I really like. And so this was a gift, and it was delightful to receive that. So, you know, having received that generosity, there was some sense of delight. And then I decided to share it with the other people on the retreat. And so I took the box of seeds. I took a piece out, maybe two even. I may have taken even two pieces out for myself. But I put the rest of the box out in the dining room. And since it was towards the end of the retreat, we were in and out of silence towards the end of this long retreat. And I sat in the dining room during a silent period. I put the chocolate out during a silent period. And I sat in the dining room and had a cup of coffee and my little See's chocolate. And I sat there and I watched people wander through the dining room, noticed the chocolate there, saw the delight in their eyes, and, you know, watched them enjoying their chocolate as they took it away. And it was like, it was such a delightful thing. You know, it's a simple, small thing, but to be witnessing the delight of somebody receiving something makes our hearts open. So sometimes we can just use reflection to help us with this, you know, to help us recognize the value and the joy that comes with generosity. And so our hearts can begin to open there in this practice or this exploration of generosity. And then the practice of ethics. You know, the practice of ethics is really a practice of non-harming. And, you know, this, I think, really integrates with what the Buddha taught about understanding suffering. Because when we engage in actions that would create harm, you know, we're in the terrain of creating suffering in the world. And so we're asked to understand that. So the suggestion is to refrain from actions that will cause harm. And again, this connects us with others. If we are open to it, we can recognize, you know, in simple ways perhaps, how being compassionate about not killing insects or being careful with the property of other people. You know, it's like it creates a condition of safety, and it's said that somebody who engages with the precepts and engages with ethical conduct gives the gift of fearlessness to all beings. And so again, this is a connection. Really, the early practices, or the practices of generosity and ethics, are practices to open our heart to each other, so that we're not so focused on me, but are engaged in this interrelationship. And with that foundation, then we can start looking into our own hearts. And again, the foundation of ethical conduct also helps us. It's a dual gift. It's a gift to others in that we're not adding harm to the world. And it's a gift to ourselves in that we're not creating the conditions for us to feel remorse and regret. And so our own hearts can have a sense of ease in, as we start to turn and look at our minds, that place of regret can be much less catching for us. Because we can even reflect on our conduct. We can reflect, yes, this is a priority for me. I am interested in engaging from this perspective of non-harming. And we'll do a number on our own minds even at times. I mean, I've seen you know, even if I engage in a way that with people that creates non-harming, I'm so ready to blame myself for something. And so I can reflect, no, I didn't actually create harm. What's happening here is there's a pattern in my mind that needs to be worked with. A pattern of habitual guilt, perhaps. A pattern of habitual shame that needs to be looked at. But that I can say, no, I didn't engage with unskillful conduct. And in the teachings also, you know, when we explore kind of the unfolding that happens, there's one progression of the practice described in the text that talks about, if you engage with ethical conduct, then freedom from remorse is a natural consequence of that. You don't have to do it. You don't have to say, oh, if I engage with ethical conduct, let me do feeling freedom from remorse. It's a natural consequence. And so it's a lawful unfolding that if we engage with kindness and ethics in our relationships, very naturally, non-remorse happens. And with non-remorse, a natural consequence of that is delight. And as delight is connected to, a natural consequence of that is joy. And it goes on, this teaching goes on to point to just how the simple practice of ethical conduct leads to all of these beautiful qualities of the heart. Delight, joy, happiness, and even deepening into concentration and seeing how our experience is created. So the path of practice, when the Buddha talks about how it unfolds, he integrates, he interweaves, he points to these qualities of heart that come along for the ride. So just even the simple practice of ethics can begin to open us to a heart that feels more easeful. Even just see if you can feel into right now, if you can imagine a heart that is not constricted with having harmed someone. A kind of a relaxation of heart there. That feeling, if we can touch into that feeling, it begins to naturally move in the direction of connection, love, delight, joy. So these are the beginning practices, the early foundational practices. They're not really beginning practices because we have to keep working with them all through our practice. But they are foundational. They are the foundation on which our inner work rests. And then when we turn inwardly, when we start actually exploring our own hearts and minds and meet the challenges. So right there, we are engaging with mindfulness, looking at something that's a struggle. So maybe turning to look at our anger or our frustration or our irritation or our agitation or our longing or our depression, whatever is there. The practice of turning towards that, one of the instructions in that exploration is to, a way to frame that instruction, let's say, is to see if you can open to and allow whatever is there. Not trying to get rid of it, not trying to hold on to it, but just meeting it with a mind, a heart that allows it to kind of be there in the space of mindfulness. So that allowing attention, that's one way we describe the practice of mindfulness, is an allowing attention. That allowing attention, to me, it contains kindness. It contains love. Because we are exploring what it means to not be in conflict with something that's challenging. And so even as we turn, if we can learn this, it's kind of this interesting middle way we're learning how to do, and it's a challenge. It's a challenge to turn towards our reactive states of mind with a mind that is friendly, with a heart that is allowing. And just willing to say, this is what it feels like to be a human being that's angry. This is what it feels like to be a human being that has longing. This is what it feels like to be a human being that's depressed right now. To not resist it and to neither resist it or wallow in it. It's this middle way the Buddha pointed to. And that middle way of receptive, allowing attention brings in the quality of love, of kindness. Now, it may not be felt that way so much initially. At least I certainly didn't really notice it as love or friendliness for quite a while. I know some people do. I mean, for some hearts, some people in their practice have kind of more of an orientation towards the qualities of heart. They're very natural for some of you to feel into those qualities. And it may be a little more difficult to feel into the understanding or the the wisdom qualities of the heart or the clarity of heart and mind that also comes with turning towards our experience. But these two things are interwoven in this simple practice of mindful attention, of kind attention. So the very act of turning towards our difficulties, our challenges, our reactivity, that very act of doing that with this allowing attention, already there is love there. And another way for me, and this may be kind of a deeper way in which love is revealed, compassion is revealed as we practice. As we turn to our challenging reactivity, as we turn to those states of heart, so often as we feel into them, I mean, what we feel, what we recognize when we turn to those states, so often is how hard they are, how uncomfortable they are. You know, when we really turn to feel anger while anger is happening, it hurts. It's not a pleasant experience. When we turn to feel longing, oh, the ache of longing. We turn to feel agitation. The mind feels so moving around. It's like it's very uncomfortable. And so these reactive states, one of the things we recognize about them, and this is where some of the wisdom comes from, is that we recognize they are suffering. Our habitual way of relating to these states is often to be focused outward in the world on the thing we're agitated about, the thing we're frustrated about, the thing we're depressed about, the thing we're angry about, and we're actually missing the uncomfortableness of the state itself. I know that was the case in my situation. I was incredibly angry, and it escaped me because I was so focused on the person that I was angry with. Until I began turning towards it, began exploring. You know, somebody sent me a book about mindfulness, and one of the things I got from that book is try to pay attention to your reactive emotions. So I did. I turned towards the anger. What does it feel like to be angry? I recognized that it hurts. And so this turning towards our reactive emotions, we feel the suffering of them. And often in that movement of feeling the suffering of them, we think, well, boy, this is not helpful. I need to get rid of this. This is a bad state. I certainly felt that about the anger. It's like, I got to figure out how to get rid of this. This is a problem. And so that can be an initial movement or an initial kind of response when we turn to our reactivity and feel the suffering of it. This is bad. What's happening here is bad. It needs to go away. And that very thought of this thing is bad, it needs to go away, that too is a form of anger, of aversion. And so this is, again, this is the middle way that the Buddha pointed to. He pointed to, okay, turn towards this reactivity, sit with it, and feel into the state of suffering, the state of being. Learn about it. Begin to understand it. As we explore it, as we have the courage to do that, as we have the courage to face our reactive emotions, and we begin to see all the different pieces that are contributing to them. You know, there's stuff in the world that contributes to our reactive emotion. Things people are doing, things that are happening out there, and there's our inner response to it. There's our fear around it, our confusion around it, our wanting things to be a certain way around it. There's all of that happening. And so we begin to see all the different pieces that are coming together that put this state together. And a piece of that, too, often, at least in my experience, over and over again, as I've been willing to sit in the middle of the fire of reactivity, I often see that somewhere in there is a wish for my own safety, my own well-being, or a wish for the well-being of my friends or my family, or the well-being of people that are being harmed. And so in the middle, often, of our reactive emotions, there is a connection to something that's really beautiful. There's a connection to a wish for freedom from suffering. There's a connection to a wish for our own well-being and the well-being of others. And that wish has gotten kind of butted up against the reality of the world, which is unreliable, which is impermanent, which is not under our control often. And so that wish for well-being and happiness is kind of coming up against reality. It's butting up against the way things are. And from that butting up against the wish for love, compassion, which I think is a very deep inner wish in most of us as human beings. I think it's rare, but I think there are some alterations in the brain that create the conditions for somebody to not have a connection with a kind of an innate sense of compassion for ourselves and others. But I think it's rare. So most of us very naturally have this wish deep, deep inside of us, a wish for love, a wish, a wholesome wish for love, not the wish for, there's also, of course, that wish, that wholesome wish for love that just really genuinely wishes well for ourselves and other beings. And then there's the wish that I get some of that back from somebody else. You know, there's the wish that I be loved by somebody else. Again, that's a little bit of a butting up against something in the world, a wanting something from the world. But very deep inside is this just simple wish. It's just the simplicity of this wish. May I be well. May my family be well. May all beings be well. And as it butts up against the struggle, the challenge of things as they are in the world, you know, we might end up feeling like, you know, as we see that this maybe this feeling of fear, there's a feeling of fear, is connected to this, you know, there's a feeling of fear, and underneath it is this deep wish for safety. And we see how unreliable things are in the world, and the collision of that wish for safety and the unreliability in the world, that's where the fear is born. That's where the fear is created, when those two collide. And we may have the feeling, as we start to recognize, wow, you know, unreliability, that's the way it is. Then we might have the sense of trying to somehow repress or feel like the wish for safety is invalid, or the wish for my well-being. I can't have that wish, or it's not a good wish to have because things are impermanent, unreliable, out of control so much of the time. Why? How can I? That wish, I need to squash that wish because it's not a good wish. That's what's creating my problem, is I'm not aligned with things are impermanent and unreliable. If I were aligned with that, I wouldn't wish to be safe. That's what our minds do, you know, think something like that. And yet, I think what the wisdom of the Buddha is asking us to do is to open to both the truth that things are often out of control, unreliable, and yet that the wish, the human wish for safety, for happiness, for health, for well-being, is a natural, wholesome wish. It's like the wisdom is asking us to hold both at the same time. It's like it's asking us to hold these two things, these two paradoxes together. And so as we turn and open to our reactivity, so often as the reactivity begins to be seen through, there is a connection to a more open heart that can hold both, that can hold the paradox of the way things are, often impermanent, unreliable, out of control, and the open heart, so that as we meet our world, there's not this collision, that reactivity, that collision, the collision creating the reactivity. That doesn't have to happen. And so this exploration of turning towards our reactivity, opening to that with this allowing heart, begins to like uncover. It's like it strips back the ways that we're kind of repressing or fearing those wishes of well-being and love and compassion. And it begins to free them up to be more fully experienced. So many times I have, it's a little bit of an interesting thing, you know, as we start to see this connection to love underneath our reactivity, we might have the sense of, okay, what I need to do with this mindfulness is dive in there and find where the connection to love is, and then I'll be able to feel that, and then that'll be okay. It's got to be more organic than that. You know, it really is that we kind of just have to sit in the messiness of our reactivity and let all of these different threads reveal themselves. The times I've been willing to do that, there has been an uncovering of, surprisingly, one time on retreat, I was spending quite a bit of time exploring depression. And it wasn't a severe depression, but it was regular and it was kind of ongoing. And so I just began looking at it and watching it and meeting it and feeling it and noticing it when it happened, and when it wasn't there, I was kind of recognizing, oh, sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not there. So I was noticing its presence, its absence, noticing what made it happen, what conditions made it come to be. I noticed it frequently happened when I saw people walking together. Like, oh, that's interesting. I also noticed it happened when not much was happening. You know, when the mind was kind of calm, it would kind of be in a very calm place and it would just kind of collapse into depression from there. So I was just noticing all of this. And then one day, as I was exploring it, there was this kind of this willingness of the heart to be with the depression in a very inside way. It was almost like I stepped right inside the depression. And there was no resistance at all to the depression. And I sat with it. And I felt it. And it felt like it grew. It felt like the depression just got enormous. It was just expanding and expanding. I was just like, wow. And feeling it and being with it. Just like from the inside, the mindfulness was meeting this depression. And the depression was getting bigger and bigger. And at some point, it was like the experience just flipped. It was like in a moment, the experience flipped. And I was sitting in the space of very expansive love. That was not what I thought I would find in the middle of depression. The very next experience, the very next moment, there was this just moment of delightful, oh, the feeling of sitting in the field of expansive love. And the very next thought in my mind was, this is stupid. This is sappy. This is corny. And wow, it was like, wow. It's like I could see in that moment that my upbringing had led me to feel that love was corny. And so I recognized in that moment, well, there's still work to do here. And yet there was something, and I could tell too that the depression in that moment, there was an understanding that the depression had come from a kind of a repression of that love. You know, that I had not been willing to be with it. Not been willing, and you know, I had this view that it was corny. And so that was keeping me in this place of depression. And so really the practice of sitting in the middle of our challenging states can begin to open us in a very deep way to beautiful, beautiful qualities of heart. And maybe we'll see, like I did, you know, that we have some opinions about those qualities of heart that need to be explored and understood. But this, to me, is really how the path of practice leads to the deepening of the qualities of love, of compassion, of joy, and of equanimity. Because it's as if so deep in our hearts there is this fundamental human wish, and it is covered over with so much reactivity. And the practice of meditation is like peeling away, peeling away, peeling away the layers of what's in the way of love and compassion and joy. And sometimes, too, I found in my own practice that, you know, it's probably, you know, something like about the configuration of this being, of my own upbringing. But there was a period of time in which there was a lot of calmness and a lot of balance in my mind. And, you know, but I wasn't very connected with the qualities of the heart. People reflected to me that they felt compassion from me or felt that sense of connectedness, but I wasn't feeling it. And as I described this to one of my teachers, my teacher said, you know, you're orienting towards wisdom, and you're orienting towards a kind of just changing experience. He said, try orienting towards connection. And so I had an opportunity to do that very shortly thereafter, you know, within minutes. And I sat down with this person. We were having a conversation, and I felt that, you know, the sense of equanimity and the sense of being able to just be there with this person without reactivity. So I was feeling that reactivity. And then I decided, oh, I need to reflect on this person as a person. I need to think about this person They need to think about who they are and what they're doing in their life. And so I did that. I brought that into my mind. And immediately there was a feeling of connection and love and compassion that was there. And so sometimes the stripping away of the layers of whatever is on top of these inner wishes, you know, it is creating the conditions for us to open to the qualities of love and joy and compassion. And yet it may not be automatically felt. At least in my case, it wasn't, you know, just work to let go of the reactivity and then boom, I'm sitting in a field of love and compassion. There was some work that needed to be done to orient to connection. And yet, it was fairly easy without having the reactivity to connect to that place of the heart. The emotions, what we might say, call the emotional map of the human heart, these qualities of love, of compassion, of joy in the joy of others, and of balance of mind. They are a natural response of the heart as reactivity goes away. And yet, we may have to open and orient to connection to feel them. Let's see if there's anything more. That's probably enough. Anybody want to say anything, any comments or thoughts about this topic? Or anything? Yeah. Why don't you use the mic?
You know, it's really interesting going on retreats because at the end they're always like, oh, just feel the generosity of your heart. And I've come to expect this. You know, that's the line. But I recently did a retreat, and at the end I was speaking with two of my roommates who had never done a retreat before, and they were kind of like, what? And I totally know that feeling. I mean, I'm still like...
You mean, what does it mean to feel the generosity
of
the heart?
I don't know if I've really totally experienced that yet. I mean, part of me is like, okay, let me calculate. How many days was I here? Da-da-da, you know? Uh-huh. That's where my head goes. Uh-huh. So it's just interesting. I hear that every time, and I don't know. I mean, I definitely do feel the generosity for what is given. But I don't know how one decides to. You have a bank account, right? I don't know.
Oh, it's yes. Just oh, a for bit. For the end of the retreat.
Yeah.
Offering
the donation. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I don't necessarily need any explanation, but it was very frustrating for my two roommates who were newbies to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is part of the. The exploration, in a way. I mean, it's like we don't like say, yeah, you know, here's what people offer, and you know, find yourself in there somewhere. You know, I used to do these elaborate calculations in my mind, but you know, at some point I began just feeling into. You know, it is more of a feeling into. There's kind of it needs a kind of a broad exploration, and it for me it's actually more than just like at the end of retreat. It's like I have to think about my life, right? I need to think about what's the conditions of my life, and what do I need to support myself? What's compassionate for myself as well as the you know, the situation? And so you know, it's a broader thing, I think, than right at the end of retreat. You know, the reflection. I think it's helpful to look at it in a broader way. And you know, so I do think of it in terms of, you know, generosity and connection, and yet, you know, it's I can't think about it in on an individual by individual basis, because, you know, I would be broke if I expressed my generosity as I would like to at every retreat.
Right.
You know, so we have to do it in a wise way. We have mm-hmm. to bring in the wisdom of reflecting on what needs to support myself as well. So it's a complex thing.
It is.
And so the complexity of it needs to be considered as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. Anything else? There's only a couple minutes left. Yeah. Did you have a question? I'm sorry. Okay, sorry. Yeah. Okay,
We are using the word generosity, love, anger, greed, defilement, animosity, this word, that word, so many words. These are our words.
Yes.
Then I think there should be another state beyond these words, because otherwise these words, we cannot define them, and I don't know what they are.
Oh yeah, I mean the experience is what's important.
Yeah.
You know, to open to the experience, and we all have our own meanings. And I think ultimately, what we look at as we turn to our inner experience is there a contraction of heart, or is there a releasing of heart? And that practice of looking at contraction or releasing of heart begins to take us towards letting go of the reactivity and cultivating the qualities of the open heart. So it can be very, very simple. We don't even really need to, identify, oh, this is anger, or, so we just meet the experience and recognize, ooh, that one hurts, or there's contraction here. It feels like I'm bundling myself up behind a wall, or there's a feeling of spaciousness and ease in meeting experience. And that simplicity can take us a long way in exploring. It's true. Because we all have different understandings. But we have to use words to communicate. That's all we have. It's just pointing, though. It's just pointing to experience. Yeah, thank you. So we need to stop. Thank you.